Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Please consider supporting Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, this is Trevor from Halifax calling in to say that I support Creative Control on Patreon because I think long-form arts journalism is a crucial part of music culture, and there's simply not enough of it out there today. Vish is a master interviewer, he lands great guests, and he has his finger on the pulse of the ever-changing music landscape, both here in Canada and abroad. For all of these reasons and many more, I think you should support Creative Control on Patreon too.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. I am Visha's wife, and I will love him no matter what you do. And now he has me on the record saying that.
Creative Control with Vish Khanna.
Dave Allen and Hugo Burnham are each musicians who are best known for being original members in the pioneering post-punk band Gang of Four. Formed in Leeds, England in 1976, Gang of Four featured Dave Allen on bass, Hugo Burnham on drums, Andy Gill on guitar and vocals, and John King on vocals. This fantastic iteration of the band released two incredible albums, 1979's Entertainment and 1981's Solid Gold. Gang of Four would go on to make more records and tour in different configurations, including live shows by its original lineup in 2004 and 2005, before Andy Gill's sad and untimely death in February 2020 due to a respiratory illness, which may have been related to his exposure to COVID-19 before very much was known about the deadly virus. Though Gill is dearly missed by his family, friends, fans, and bandmates, his legacy lives on in the music of Gang of Four, which sounds as inspired and innovative now as it did when it was first unleashed. In fact, Matador Records recently released Gang of Four 77-81, a remarkably designed vinyl box set that captures the band's earliest demos and recordings, its first two albums, live performances, rare photographs, and other contextual ephemera via a 100-page book. While the limited edition vinyl set might be available at your local record store, as I'm speaking to you, it's otherwise sold out. However, a CD version of the box will be available to order on April 23rd, 2021. To celebrate Gang of Four 77-81, I recently connected with Dave and Hugo, and we discussed how Gang of Four came to be and their uniquely egalitarian approach to making music and noises together, how listening to reggae and seeing shows by Bob Marley, Ramones, the Sex Pistols, the Clash, the Damned, and Talking Heads, among others, influenced them and their own approach to making music, the 2020 death of guitarist Andy Gill, and why Gang of Four might still play together again someday, this new 77-81 box set and forthcoming Gang of Four reissues, other future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it, and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, with additional support from Blackbird Music, a well-stocked record store with locations in Edmonton and Calgary, and friendly staff who will happily help you source special orders for hard-to-find titles, which you can learn more about at blackbird.ca, and Massey Hall's concert film series live at masseyhall.com, where you can stream dozens of 30-minute films for free, including performances by past podcast guests like Born Ruffians, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. This is the 609th episode of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Dave Allen and Hugo Burnham of Gang of Four, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hello, Gang of Four. Gang of Four, are you there?
Gang of Two.
Gang of Two.
Gang of Two. It's been reduced a little bit,
We're the back row. We're the rhythm section here.
Yeah, we're the best.
One of the greatest rhythm sections of all time, if I might say.
Thank you, Vish. Very thrilled to
speak with you. As a drummer myself, I know what it's like to be in a rhythm section. So I really am honored to speak with you. And I'm going to, for those listening, let's introduce ourselves. I'm going to introduce you, I suppose. Dave, are you there?
I am here. Yes. Hello.
Nice to meet you, sir. Can you first of all, where in the world are you?
I live in Portland. That's where I am. I'm in my living room here, you know, but it's Portland. Yeah.
I can detect
it's cold.
It's cold, is it? Yeah. It gets still a little cold. Yeah, I detect a Portland accent there. So that's
no. Me and Hugo are English.
Is that right? Okay, I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure about that. I was like, is that the Portland? Is that how people talk? Where? How long have you been?
It is. You know what? You actually came across something very well there, because it's Portlanders have a very flat accent. You know, you wouldn't know that they were from Portland if you met them in LA or came up to, you know, Edmonton where you are.
Yeah, yeah.
You wouldn't know they were from Portland. It doesn't have an accent.
Yeah, that's fair. I've had several Portlanders on the show, and I think I agree with you. They're nondescript. I don't even remember the conversations. That's how flat they were. No, I'm just kidding. It is very nice to speak with you, Dave, and thank you for establishing yourself there. And Hugo, are you there?
I am here.
And yeah, there he is.
Here is specifically Massachusetts. I live up on the North Shore of Massachusetts, the south side of Boston. And right now I'm not at home. I'm at work. I teach at Endicott College up on the North Shore. And I'm in my office. It's warm, relatively. It's going to snow tonight, though, because, you know, if you don't like the weather in New England, just wait 3 minutes and it'll change.
Yeah, it's exactly true. That's the way it is in the Maritimes in Canada, too.
I do not sound like a Massachusetts person at all.
You said, if you take away the new in New England, you got the England. Yeah. That's what you got.
Yeah, yeah.
I describe myself as an old Englander in New England.
That's right. There you go. If I may ask, just out of curiosity, what do you teach at the university or the
school? Well, I've been teaching since 2000. I started teaching to music and TV and radio students, all the basics of the entertainment industry. And then I started teaching what I call real subjects like English literature and critical thinking and all that sort of thing. Hmm. Taught political science. But what I do now for Endicott College is I run the internship program for the visual and performing arts school here. So all the kids who are in doing those majors, I help them manage their internships.
I see. Okay, so you're not in the realm of teaching people how to play music per se.
Oh, no, I don't teach music. Good God, no. I'm a drummer. I'm not a musician. No, I do not teach music. Although occasionally we have a studio here, recording studio as well as a rehearsal studio. Next week, for instance, I'm sitting in with one of the professors who teaches audio engineering 1 and 2. And he's asked me, because my drum kit is in the studio because I go and practice there every now and again.
Yeah.
So he's asked me to participate in the class when he's teaching them about miking and recording drums.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah. We moved to Edmonton. I've only been here about a year and a bit. And so I, for the first time in 20 years, I have a drum kit set up in my house. I can actually go and bang about if I want to just play. And it's really fun. Do you try to play every day kind of thing, or?
I wish I could play every day. I have the intention of playing every day, but then it's suddenly I'm working away. I mean, you know, we work hard here.
Yeah.
And I look up and it's 5 o'clock and it's, yeah, then I'm done.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
during the summer, it's much easier because most of the kids are off campus. So I do, yeah, I go and play quite regularly. I just bash away or I play along to songs. Yeah.
Yeah. So
I have a kit at home as well, but it's an electronic kit just because it makes too much noise otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. That's I had a little bit of that going on every once in a while. I would rent those things and they're kind of fun, but not as satisfying physically. Like, it's not the same visceral. You don't get it back at you. You know, it's in your head. I don't like as much.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, Dave, I want to ask you, I neglected to ask you about your own sort of pursuits while you're in Portland. But before I get to that, Hugo, you're dealing with a small, tiny children in your workplace. Are any of them like, holy shit, the drummer from Gang of Four is here? I got to talk to that guy. Do you ever get that?
Not as much as I used to.
Yeah.
But I normally get about week two or three into it is, oh, Professor Burnham, my dad told me to tell you.
Yeah.
It's always the dads,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah. I get that. I get that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dave, you've taught as well, haven't you, Dave?
Yeah. At the University of Oregon, I was teaching there.
Okay, back to you, Dave. What are you doing in Portland, and what were you, before we get to that even, what were you teaching at the university?
At the university was just, they asked me to just be there and, you know, work with the kids. It was really interesting because you get in the room and all the back row is all the guys, like the athletes, mm-hmm, and they're like, you know, yeah, and they got their computers open and so, you know, it was really funny. I would say, so are you watching porn now? Are you guys in the back there? You know, and then down the front is all the females who want to do the right thing, like,
yeah,
get interested in me and help them out and things like that. It was good. I really enjoyed it. But then I joined Apple and they said I couldn't do that anymore.
Yes. Okay.
I had to stop.
Yes, you've worked for some major computer conglomerates. Is that what you're doing right now?
No. So it started out with eMusic. You know eMusic?
I'm familiar with it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then that went under, and then Intel brought me up here to Portland, and that just is why I'm here.
Okay. You know,
brought me up here.
Okay,
yeah.
Nice.
And at the moment, we have a thing called DIN Workshop with my friend Skylar Jessen, who lives in Brooklyn. And we could do all sorts of things. We're working with Splice. You've probably heard of Splice, right?
I don't believe I have heard of Splice. What is Splice?
Well, if you look it up, splice.com, you know, it's where you can push beats. So you're a drummer, right?
Yeah, I am. Yeah.
So if you want to put some beats up on their website, and some comes along like Kanye West or something,
yeah,
you'll get paid really well.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I'm a bit distracted. Hugo's got a ruler or something. I don't know what he's doing. He's got a ruler.
I don't know what he's doing.
Screen. Is he measuring us? What are you measuring, Hugo? I'm distracted.
Yeah, I'm you know.
He's trying to measure his penis.
It's a little high. A little high to be doing that kind of exam, that self-exam. You're up
right,
by,
right.
Anyway,
right.
Sorry, Dave. Okay, so you're...
No. We're good. So Skylar is based in Brooklyn, and there's a big production room that we can help all sorts of artists who own their own copyrights. That's what we do.
Okay.
It's called DIN Workshop. And it's been fine, you know. Like, Splice has been really good to us. They pay us monthly, you know.
Nice.
Like they want us to keep with them.
Okay.
So that's good. It's not the greatest. I haven't made a lot of money out of it yet. But at least it's something. You know,
I think that's what a lot of people are going through right now. At least I can do something.
No, I know. I know. I mean, like the whole of 2020, I didn't really make much money at all.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I want to actually circle back in time. I mean, we are just the fact that we're celebrating this excellent Gang of Four box set. I assume you're doing a lot of this time traveling, if you will, conversational time traveling. And Hugo, I want to start with you in terms of your recollection of meeting Dave. And obviously, Dave, you can interject. You can fact check as we go. But Hugo, do you have any recollection?
No. This is good. Hugo might start.
I absolutely do. It's really clear. Well, when John, Andrew, and I first started playing in April of 77?
76.
Yeah. Anyway, we had a bass player we did two shows with who was a Chinese studies student who he was there. He didn't gel. And we all went away for the summer. We thought, okay, if we're going to do this, we've got to do this properly.
Yeah.
And when we came back to campus in September, I put up a notice on the...
I like that notice.
Yeah, on the board at the University Student Union. And it said, Fast Rhythm and Blues, spelled right. R-I-V-V-U-M, bass player wanted.
Yeah, and I understood really that.
He understood it.
I understood that. I knew what that was. And then I came to your house.
You came to my house?
You remember? And you came out in your dressing gown, and it looked like Elton John. You know?
Was
Thank
it?
Thank you very much.
Hugo,
I lived on Harold Avenue in Leeds at the time.
Just to clarify something, Dave, when he showed up in the dressing gown, was he holding a ruler? I just want to make sure everything was above board.
It was all above board, because there were people in the streets.
Okay,
you know?
just making sure. Sorry to interject.
So so he came in and started rehearsing with us, and it was obvious in a matter of moments that he was right for us. And, you know, it's as much about the person as the way they play.
I know. So, and that's the thing. I mean, when we were rehearsing in the Leeds University room, I can't remember which room we were in, you know.
The Tartan Bar, down at the bottom of the Union.
Yeah, I know, but it just gelled, right? It just gelled. Yeah. You and I, for instance, you know, we hit it off really quickly.
We did, which was very lucky because Dave actually was the true musician in the band. I mean, he'd been playing for years, doing lots of different types of music.
Yeah.
And to be honest, we had to tell him to play less because he could play a lot more than we could. So it's like
too many notes.
Yeah. Less Jaco, more free.
It wasn't Jaco.
Now, I'm just curious because you two play together very distinctively, I should say, and, you know, really influenced a lot of people, and the whole band did. But, Dave, in terms of your playing, do you have any recollection of what influenced your approach to your instrument? I'm just curious because it is very unique. Some would use the term pioneering, but I also know that sometimes when you're in a band, you're not only playing the music you want to make, but you're kind of playing in opposition to the stuff you don't like. You know what I mean?
I can tell you what I did was, you know, the Meters, Meters.
Yeah, the band. Yeah,
I loved them, and I was living in an apartment on my own in Kendall in the Lake District, and it just came to me, and then Bootsy Collins.
Yes.
Right. That's why.
Yes.
I'm a little more funky in a sense. I really like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of gelled with like the band, you know, like Hugo, I think Hugo understood what was going on. And like Andrew, you know, it's like the whole like in and out and things like that.
I think what we all understood in terms of what we gelled around was quite a percussive way of playing.
Yes.
Rather than just holding or maintaining a beat, you know, Andrew's playing was quite percussive, and we played in and around each other. Nobody was really supporting anyone else.
Right.
It was all on the front line together.
But then there was the whole Chapeltown thing as well, when we used to go and listen to all the reggae.
Yeah. Late night Shebeens, big sound systems.
Okay. So
and also
legal drinking.
Well, also the Jamaicans who flew over from Jamaica with like test pressings.
Yeah.
DJs were playing them in the room.
So were you primarily, you mentioned a few people and sort of forms there. Were you primarily listening to music, or could you see the music that you were excited about? Like, were people coming to town? Could you go to shows? I'll send that to Hugo. Hugo, were you going to concerts a lot?
Absolutely. There were a lot of shows. Leeds, the university where some of us were studying, was one of the most important stops on any UK tour. The refectory, which is an English word for large dining room in the university, made famous initially by Live at Leeds, by The Who.
Right.
But every major tour stopped there, whether it was the Stones, Led Zeppelin, it was maybe 1,000 capacity. Everyone played there. My first year, I saw Bob Marley. I saw the Commodores.
Wow.
The Stiff Tour. The first Stiff Tour came through there.
Yeah, that was great. Didn't we see The Clash as well? They were there?
No. Well, the first time we all saw... Yeah, the Clash played there. But the first time we all saw the Clash was actually on the Anarchy Tour. The Sex Pistols, mm-hmm. the Clash, the Heartbreakers and the Dandel, all for £1.
Holy Lord.
And that was down in the venue at Leeds Polytechnic, which was literally just across the bridge over the freeway, highway, motorway, from the university, where we also saw the Ramones and Talking Heads on their first tour together.
Yeah.
It's a smaller venue, but they, you know, again, very much an art school-oriented polytechnic.
I mean,
great artists came out of there with, you know, Green Gartside with Scritti, Frank Tovey and Fad Gadget, Mark Almond, Soft Cell.
Yeah.
They were all students there. And then we were up at the, just, you know, half a mile up the hill at the university, you know, whether it was us, Delta Five, Mekons. So it was really a hotbed of shows. There were small shows, there were shows at pubs, shows at these Shebeens, you know, and great dancing. There was one of the university clubs was called the Grand Funk Society.
Hmm.
And five times a term, they would have a huge dance. It was just like a big disco, but it was all heavy R&B and African music, and just everyone to go. It was all about drinking and dancing. But there were a lot of shows that we could go and see, all sizes. So it was great.
So Hugo, you've used the term we several times. Dave, did you attend all these shows? Did the people in Gang of Four tend to congregate and go to these shows together? Were you friends in that regard?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. I mean, I can't remember which shows I went to, but, you know.
and strikingly, I will say, you've cited a lot of artists who are black, a lot of music that was made by black artists. So I find that fascinating, too, because when I hear Gang of Four, I mean, I wasn't there, obviously, when you were really at it. I was born in 77, so obviously I wasn't, even if I could go to your shows, I would have been probably having a nap. I was a baby. But my point is, if I could, with Gang of Four playing, probably not. I guess I'm just wondering about your peers. You mentioned The Clash, who are among the people you just mentioned, The Clash are contemporaries. But who was making music, Dave, like Gang of Four? Was anyone doing what you guys were doing, or were you influenced by local artists?
No, I don't think so. I mean, when we recorded Entertainment, it was like we'd already sort of been on the road. It was like live rehearsals on the road, and then we go into the what was the studio, Hugo? I forget.
The first time we recorded was brain 20 minutes ago.
Oh, you mean the little EP, the Damaged Goods EP?
Yeah. Yeah, that was at Cargo Studios.
Yes.
In Rochdale, near Manchester.
It was up in the Pennines.
Right.
Yeah, Rochdale.
Right.
But we did a lot of rehearsing and recording in our own rehearsal room as well.
That's true. You know, yeah.
We started in the university, then it was in a room that the Film Society had, which was up above the Fenton Pub. You talk about we. I mean, that was the gathering center socially for every sort of artist, musician, LGBTQ, old people, socialist.
And the Nazis.
And then the Nazis would come and start
Nazis,
playing.
Yeah.
Start beating us up, yeah.
You would think at this point we could stop talking about the Nazis. Like, this is crazy that we still have to talk about the Nazis. You're talking about an era 40 years ago, and they're still back. Anyway, maybe a whole...
Excuse me. This country still has not ratified the Equal Rights Amendment.
Yes, I know.
About things we shouldn't be talking about.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say, like, you know, when we recorded Entertainment, what was that studio we were in, Hugo?
We recorded Entertainment in the Workhouse studio in South London, down on the Old Kent Road.
And I was talking yesterday to this guy from the Minneapolis radio station about it. Let's say, like, the engineer wanted to put, like, reverb on everything. It would never have been Entertainment if we'd allowed him to put reverb on everything.
Yeah.
It would never sound like it does today. So when you get the box set right now, it's like 40 years, and it sounds like it was just recorded yesterday.
Yes, absolutely. Right. And I guess what we're getting at is a bit of dryness there, like the actual stark reality of what was going on in the room is what we're hearing, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was interesting. There was, like, Annie Lennox came in one day because they were doing something down the hallway. Like, studios have more than one studio.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And she was like what we would call in England, like, gobsmacked, you know. It's like, wow, you know. Then there was somebody else who came in. Do you remember, Hugo, the guy who had a number one song? I can't remember his name.
Tom Robinson?
Yes.
Tom Robinson with 2468 Motorway.
He came in and he almost lost his mind.
Right. Well,
they would say this is something we've never heard before, you know. Like,
well, I still have a visceral memory, like a sense memory of first hearing Gang of Four after hearing all the bands you influenced and being like, oh, here's where it all came from. Here's where this notion of kind of starting to play, stopping to play to let other people play, like, you know, no, like the minimalism, I suppose, is what we would call it. Like, it's a remarkable approach to songwriting.
I'll pull this back a bit to the thought you were introducing a short while ago about, you know, black music.
Yes.
Growing up in England, it was far more a part of our whole sort of musical zeitgeist than I think Americans were ever used to.
Right.
We grew up with reggae infused into everything. Every week on Top of the Pops, which was the weekly chart show on the BBC, reggae was as much a part of pop music as anything else. We were all very aware of, you know, and then diving deeper into dub reggae, which wasn't pop reggae. Which definitely informed our whole dropping out sort of thing and leaving space. So.
Right. But then let's talk about the 2005 reunion.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking about this yesterday. There was a lot of music critics who said some bands sound just like Gang of Four. And it was like, no, you should come to a show. So we joined, we did a 2005. How long were we out for? It's quite a while, wasn't it?
On and off for about 18 months before I pulled back and out of it.
This is this is for the album Return the Gift, and that featured the original lineup of the band after the band had had different people, right?
Well, yeah, the band had gone through various iterations, but the whole point was that people wanted the original lineup to go and perform again. I mean, Return the Gift was a sort of side venture. We weren't touring to support the album. That was just a side venture.
Okay, I see.
That was because, you know, we were on EMI and we were like years out where you're allowed to redo your own songs.
Yeah.
So we did. Okay. That was Return the Gift.
Right, I understand. So it's very strange to me that, like, do you guys feel like the band is sort of underrated on that level? Like, we've talked about, we haven't cited anyone, but I've heard your influence over the years. Hugo, you're saying, earlier you said, I don't really hear from the kids anymore. I hear from their dads. So, but are you?
Yeah, no, I was being a little facetious.
You know, Hugo, let me talk about the dads that when we were in Shepherd's Bush. You remember what was that? What's that show?
The Shepherd's Bush Empire.
Yes, and then there's a great photo I have of like somebody up on the balcony, like taking photos. Like of crowds, and there's all these guys with bald heads trying to keep their children, you know, like don't, well, let's not rush up to the front, you know.
But seriously, to talk about particularly that tour in 2005, what we found there, that tour, you know, all that touring we did in the States and Europe, the audiences were split between people of our age and generation and their children.
Yes.
You know, late teenagers, kids in their 20s who had discovered it through these other artists who sounded like us.
Well, when we
went to investigate their sources, and we were pleasantly.
Well, Coachella worked really well because Trent Reznor asked us to basically open for him.
Yeah.
And that was a huge crowd there.
Yeah.
There's a lot of young people who probably had never seen us before.
Yeah.
Because you know, everybody goes to Coachella, you know, it's just like blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
After that, then we moved up the West Coast and every show we did was totally packed and sold out. We ended up in San Francisco.
Two nights
in San Francisco. And then we went up to...
We did Portland, absolutely. Portland, Seattle, Vancouver. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the audiences were really well peopled by people, young and old.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I want to dial back into the band dynamic at the time that some of the records we're kind of talking about today were formed, because we were talking about the way you guys approach playing, and we've alluded to authenticity, you know, not a lot of artifice within this band. And then when I was kind of thinking about, obviously I've been thinking about the records a lot more in the lead up to this conversation, and the kind of stopping and starting that we've been describing, where band members come and go. When I think about that authenticity thing and what else was going on in popular music, there's a real interesting ego situation going on in Gang of Four, I find. It takes a lot of ego for a musician, or a lot of humility, I would say, for a musician to stop playing. Most musicians overplay. They're asserting themselves. Was that ever discussed on some level? Like, we're all, like, everyone gets a little space. Like, Hugo, do you know what I'm kind of getting at there? Like, that's very fascinating to me that you gave each other some space to express yourselves.
Well, it was discussed constantly. Hmm. That's your answer.
That's the answer, yeah. Okay, but
it was, and, you know, it was far more interesting not to go into the, okay, whenever there's a bit of air, I'm going to hit a cymbal, for instance.
Yes.
Or guitar solos. It just wasn't interesting.
I get that stylistically. What I'm saying is philosophically, psychologically, does that notion of like spreading the wealth, we don't, you know, I can step back and be comfortable doing that with these three guys. I don't need to be playing all the time. That speaks to a certain humility too. Like, I understand what you're saying. It's an aesthetic choice. It's interesting. But Dave, do you know what I'm getting at? Like, I'm not trying to suggest you guys are some noble knights that, you know, like, the ultimate men, you know, who know how to treat people. But like, I am getting at that a little bit. Like, that takes a lot. When you're young in particular, when you're a young person and you're playing music,
I'm not a young person.
Well, when you were a young person. I know this from my own experience. Like, you're playing constantly. You're trying to assert yourself and show people that you know what you're doing. For people to kind of step back, I think is very fascinating on some level.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like if you were at the live shows, you'll see that it works out really well.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, and the audience like it. And if we've stopped playing, for instance, they sometimes sing along, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
If you look to some of our significant influences, let's take the English classic sort of blues rock band Free. Their music was so much about space and about tension and release.
Yeah.
That informed us very strongly.
Right.
Yeah. It did.
Okay. So
nobody overplayed there.
So we had all sorts of folks with us, you know, in the early days as well. You know, R.E.M. came on the road with us.
I didn't know that.
And then turned into, like, you know, a huge freaking, you know.
Like a pop band, ostensibly.
Left us behind.
Yeah. Well, we've talked a little bit about your dynamic together as a rhythm section. What about your relationship with, you mentioned Andrew, who I always think of Andy. And we miss Andy. Andy and I spoke, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, and it meant the world to me to get to chat with him. And if I may, I know it's been some time, but my condolences to you two for the loss of your friend. It hurt all of us.
That was something that we were not expecting at all. I mean, we knew that he was not well at some point, and then we got an email saying that he died in February of 2020.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah, I mean, in a weird way, actually, I think, you know, I really miss him. When we were doing some rehearsals in last January at Hugo's studio there in the college, there was a female guitarist there, and it was like, it just wasn't quite right for me. You know, it's like, it was like really loud and it wasn't what Andrew did, you know, because Andrew was like what Hugo said earlier, he's percussive. He was playing percussive.
Yeah.
And always when we were in rehearsals, that helped me along. You know what I mean? Well, like those notes.
Yeah. What were you in rehearsals for in January of 2020, if I might ask?
Well,
just hanging out together to play it. Cause Andrew was on the road with his last version of Gang of Four with three session players or people who've been with him on and off for a while.
Yeah.
But he went to China.
Yeah, and he was in China. The three of us wanted to play together and see what it was like. And we found a young woman who was really good and interesting.
So yeah, just, was it you?
It was the holidays and we were here. Yeah. John was visiting the States. So we thought we'd see what it was like.
Oh, John was involved as well. So it was ostensibly Gang of Four.
Yeah, he was visiting here. I mean, you know, we're very friendly and social.
Yeah.
We put a lot of time together. So, yeah, we were just seeing what it was like again, because we do love to be in each other's company. I mean,
yeah,
we weren't very kind to each other at times. We were very tough on each other musically, but we did we loved each other.
Yeah.
I know, there's something with Andrew in that, you know what I mean? Like, it's like,
Very. So this is where I was kind of coming from earlier when I was stumbling about trying to talk about the ego dynamic. Four very strong personalities also at play here. So that's what I mean. When you have four strong personalities, selfishness can fester. And you guys were the opposite to me, at least in terms of your musical approach. It wasn't selfish. It was selfless. It was for the service of the song. And if I have to stop playing, then I'm going to stop playing if I'm going to, you know, and we'll play together. Anyway, I just wanted to dial back to my question. We've talked about your dynamic. What was it like working with John and Andrew? I think we've covered this on some level, but for you two as the rhythm section to work with that guitar player and that singer, Hugo, what was that like? How did the styles kind of work out?
Well, we weren't the rhythm section in that respect. There wasn't that divide. That might be more common. It was like, you know, the four corners of the whatever, the four elements. The way that the Who, for instance, there wasn't a rhythm section and then the two front guys.
Yeah, that's true.
Each element was as important as the other and relied on each other. But yeah, I mean, we fought and we argued about a lot of things. but I think any significant creativity between people, It's an Kinks Brothers, The Who, everyone fights.
It was kind of easy. You know, it's like there was always some sort of like arguments that we actually could clean up real quickly. You know, it's
just like, it's just four forceful personalities trying to make the most interesting music we could.
Yeah,
I mean, Hugo,
and I think you're right. You know, Bish, you were right when you said it's like four people in a rehearsal room. Who, yes, we all had our, you know, what we wanted to do, not being selfish, but just trying to push it. You know,
yeah,
get it.
Pushed ourselves and each other equally.
Exactly.
You know, Hugo, you mentioned that there is no rhythm section in Gang of Four, and as you say it, I realize that that's totally true in the aspect that Andy would play percussively. Arguably, yes. John sang with a certain syncopation. Actually, like it was all like the whole thing was kind of
the whirling dervish.
Yeah, like the whole thing is very rhythm. It's pretty much rhythmic. Like, yeah, that's a fascinating. Like, we don't really
John on stage, you know.
Yeah,
so that goes back again to our influences and the fact that we, you know, among other things, we all loved to dance.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it,
and that's why we moved you know, Andrew, me and John were moving around a lot, you know, on the front of the stage.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Obviously Hugo's sitting back there with the drums. Yeah. And it was fine. It was like, it worked. John and Andy would be wrestling or something on stage and whatever. You know.
Did they like each other? I can't tell. Did those two like each other?
They had been tight friends since they were about 15. They went to high school together. John came up to university a year before Andrew did.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, like brothers.
I mean right. they fell out a bit, though.
Yeah.
You know? Well, yeah, like one does with brothers, you know.
Yeah.
I know, but, you know, it was like, you know, Andrew would, like, recorded something and then licensed it to some record label and didn't pay John.
Yeah,
you know, there was a lot of stuff going on. You know, it's like,
yeah, okay. Well, we don't have to get mired in that necessarily. It's certainly none of my business. I shouldn't have even broached it, but I'm just curious because there.
Yeah, it's fine.
We have sort of portrayed the band as this egalitarian entity, or at least I have. But it's true, there was tension that was driving you, mm-hmm. like tension in terms of thought and action as well. The band, beyond the musical innovation, the band has long been associated with a certain kind of political sort of stance.
Somewhat political. You know, we did Rock Against Racism on flatbed trucks in London, things like that. You had to like move on when the cops came and things like that. And then there was a national front, you know.
There's capital P politics, and then there's lowercase p politics, if I might.
Well, that's what we were, lowercase p politics. And you know, so like, in other words, if you listen to the lyrics and all, it's about like, it's not about political stuff like Margaret Thatcher or the Labour Party. You know, everyone thought that we were anti-Margaret Thatcher, but she was not in power at the time when we did Entertainment.
Yeah.
And so... the Labour Party was making a mess of things. But yes, the small p I've always used when people ask me, like, you know, are you Marxists and things? What? No, we're not Marxists, you know. You know, the small p is like, you can talk to people and say, well, look, if someone comes to me and says, like, you know, I love your album, blah, 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 what should I be doing?
Yeah.
And I said, well, you know, what do you do? And they said, well, you know, I work in a record store or something, but I want to go out to the beach and surf. And I said, well, okay, so you can do that. But there'll be something that if that guy who is your boss finds out you've gone surfing, you're going to lose your job.
Yeah.
So that's the small p thing. Right?
That's politics too. I feel like that's fair.
It is small politics, yeah.
Well, I think, Hugo, do you have any thoughts on what we're discussing? And also within that, I just want to clarify one thing, and maybe Hugo, you can do this. Like, did all of you have input in terms of lyrics? Like, did you all kind of offer ideas and advice in that regard?
Generally, no. There would be... tweaking around the edges arguments, but if John is singing it, those were principally his lyrics.
Okay.
If Andy was singing it, those were principally his lyrics.
Right.
Yeah.
The one song I sang were mostly my lyrics. but I passed them by John because I wasn't sure about it.
And what song is that?
It's Her Factory.
Okay, okay. So,
but I mean,
that's on the Yellow EP, right?
Yeah, I think so. But I think Dave's point was not so much about party and governmental politics, more right. about politics of people's relationships.
Community politics, in a sense. Community politics, I would say.
Yeah, no, yeah. Right. that's really where Damaged Goods is. You know, it's like, if you listen to the whole lyrics throughout that song, well, it's about all sorts of things.
Yeah, know? And Hugo, just to clarify, I don't mean like city council politics. I mean like the politics of walking out your door. Yeah, walking out your door and negotiating other people, social norms, what to consume, what not to consume, what we're bombarded with. I feel like all of that is in Gang of Four a little bit. Like, how do we think critically about these lives we're leading? Would you agree with that, Hugo?
Yeah.
Done.
There's all sorts
I did
on.
It. I got an A.
Yeah, hang on. Hey, Hugo.
Hey.
You know, when Thatcher had got in and there was like, we went to a working man's club somewhere where the cops were on all sides. And who was it that came with us? That, you know, the guy who just gave us a review on the box set.
Oh, Gary Bushell?
No. The guy from
okay.
So we got an email from him when somebody dropped it off at his door, right? The box set.
Oh,
Grail Marcus.
Yes, Grail Marcus.
Oh, so Grail Marcus. Holy cow.
Yeah, I know. Grail Marcus was in the transit, the maroon transit that Hugo had bought. And he was kind of really, really scared, you know, because there
were
Molotov cocktails flying around, the cops everywhere, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, Grill had come to England to do a piece about us and the Raincoats and one or two other acts.
Okay.
Because that was on the Rolling
Stone.
The day
or two he spent with us, we were in something of a incipient riot, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
For what it's worth, Grail Marcus is a hero of mine and was on the show once talking about Bob Dylan many years ago. And so that's weird.
All these
connections. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I do want to I want to talk a little bit about what you've included in this collection since you reference it. By the way, did Grail Marcus give this a nice review?
Yeah.
he just wrote it yesterday.
Okay, good. Yeah. I'm glad. I haven't read that yet. Let's get into the actual set here and what you've added to it. So just so people understand this, the two albums featured are Entertainment and Solid Gold. And they've been, I think, remixed and remastered. Is that correct?
Not remixed. Remastered from the very original masters that have been kept stored at Abbey Road.
Okay.
All these years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So then the other side, or the other sides, I should say, there's a singles collection. There is Live at American Indian Center 1980. And then there's some demo cassettes that are super, super fascinating. These are capture recordings made at the rehearsal room in Leeds, which you may have alluded to earlier, Cargo Studio, the Polydor Studios, and some demos that were made at Abbey Road. So it's very extensive and interesting. And it also comes with what is like a 100-page book. Is that correct?
100-page book full of, I mean, the defining and last word on the lyrics, because over the years, lots of people have printed the lyrics and been wrong or made mistakes. You know, some of them, there's a couple I only learned about finally in the last few months doing this. Which was funny. There are photographs, official and otherwise. There are lovely memories and things from friends, people we used to work with, other artists, be they musical or filmmakers or whatever, and even copies of some of the rejection letters we got from record companies back in the day. So it's full and it's fabulous. And
nice.
It took a lot of work to put it all together.
Now, Dave, what was your, I just want to get at your roles in constructing this thing. Dave, what would you say was your particular role in assembling this new collection?
Actually, I didn't really have much input in it, to be honest, you know, because John was doing everything in a sense, you know, because like the box set is recycled cardboard. And he found, because he had an office in Copenhagen, because when he was working for Vice, I think it was. And he found a guy who was a designer who
industrial engineer.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Yeah, yeah. And you know, he was the one who came up with the idea of the cardboard box. And if we can get you one, you know, if we can get you the box set, you'll see how it works. You know, like it sort of slots together, and then you can pull it out. And
there is actually a terrific video of John doing an unboxing that Matt will have.
Okay. Yeah.
I'll check that out. How it all fits together.
Okay.
I mean, John drove the project.
Yeah.
They seem to have a lot of stuff and did a lot of scanning here, but luckily enough at the school, we've got all that, you know, in the photo studio and things.
Oh, nice.
So, you know, and Dave wrote stuff and I wrote stuff and we went to our old compatriots to pull stuff together for it.
Okay.
I did have an input. I did write
some. Yeah, you did some stuff, Dave. Don't sell yourself short, Dave. You did stuff. Now, Dave, Hugo, you were saying at some point in our conversation that there were lyrics that surprised you. Is that correct?
Yes.
So there are things that surprised you. Do you want to cite any? Was there anything that struck you as particularly interesting?
No. It wasn't anything interesting. There was a line that I got wrong for 40 years. And, well, I'm not going to give it away because there is a wonderful writer who's been a great friend for years, whose name we might already have mentioned, who said that he had the same error in the lyrics. Our version of "Excuse Me While I Kiss This Guy." you'll read about it quite soon.
No! It's Kevin, right?
No, Grill. Grill and I both thought the particular line was the same thing. No, Kevin also.
It's Kevin Detmar where he got Ether wrong.
Yeah,
right. And that's why
he did.
That's why I've got a little thing in here that's Mom de Green. You know what that means, right?
Yeah. So you've got a 33 and a third. Book on entertainment, I assume. Is that what you've got there?
Kevin Detmar, you know, he was at the same school teaching alongside David Foster Wallace.
Right.
But he thought Ether and Rock All, right?
Yeah.
And he thought that was Fuck All.
Well, to his credit or whatever, I mean, it can be kind of hard to decipher what John is caterwauling about sometimes. You kind of get the feeling, if not the meaning, all the time, if you know what I mean. And
So
what I was getting at there, I suppose, is that Hugo was surprised by something 40 years later. I want to take this to Dave. Dave, was there anything about revisiting this material, these recordings, this ephemera, anything surprise you? Anything where you're like, holy, I didn't know we did that, or
No. You mean you're talking about the box set?
The
now,
set
right?
in particular, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think because John had also gone to Abbey Road to get the albums.
The demo recordings or?
No.
I had those.
Oh, to get it remastered, you mean?
Yeah, remastered.
Right.
Yeah. I don't think there's anything surprising me in the albums, you know, because I've got the box set and you know, I can play it, obviously. But, you know, the book is amazing. You know what I mean? That was something that I'm really impressed with. You know, it takes us back 40 years.
Yeah.
And you'll see in there pictures of like where we used to rehearse. It looked like it just been bombed by the Germans. I'm not joking.
Well, yeah, you're not joking. Yeah, that might have been the case. Yeah.
Yeah, it could have been. Yeah. And there was huge potholes full of water. Did you say, Hugo, that John fell into one once?
I think we fell out quite a lot back in those days.
Hugo,
I'm most surprised. What most surprises me about looking through all this book is how fantastically good looking I used to be.
Yeah.
Years of Andy telling me I was a fat bastard, you know.
Oh, you're a handsome man, Hugo. No. Don't sell yourself short either. This has now become just an affirmation.
Don't call me short.
It's an affirmation session for Gang of Four now. I'm just leading reinforcement.
So my wife saw pictures of me wearing certain clothes, and she said, "Why do you wear those clothes?"
Well, it is a remarkable collection and a nice testament to this band, obviously. In terms of the scope of it, was there any thought to doing kind of a complete Gang of Four set? I understand this captures the original blast and the original lineup, but do you plan, or do you know if there are other plans to gather the rest of the material that particularly Andy?
Well, okay, Andy? So I can tell you specifically that as part of the catalogue that Matador picked up will be the third album, Songs of the Free, which we made after Dave went off to form Shriekback,
yeah,
which Sarah Lee played on. That's the 40th anniversary of that release is next year. So
I see.
We are planning some, obviously not as comprehensive and large as this, but it'll be a proper re-release with, re-release plus. There'll be something else with it as well. So,
okay, great.
Yeah, that's underway.
Okay. Now, Dave, you both alluded to the notion that you got together in January of 2020 just to feel, just to play. And I read something in the biographical information that came with this record, and it was provocative. Mm-hmm. It suggested that Gang of Four may not be totally done. Was that facetious? Like, Dave, do you think Gang of Four in some capacity could continue or come back and play?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, that's what we've been doing. Like, I flew out from here to Massachusetts to get into the rehearsal room at the college. I'm thinking now that, so Hugo, Andrew died on February 1st, right?
Yeah.
Going out in January, that was a bit weird.
Well, I mean, it was, listen, you know, we were looking into the idea of doing something again. Obviously, last year, everything went to shit for everybody. Whether or not we would be going out on the road became far less important.
Right.
But obviously the three of us love being around and playing with each other. And, you know, but it will take something quite extraordinary to be able to go out and play authentically, to find somebody who can in some way fill in for, I won't use the word replace, but fill in for Andrew,
yeah,
and do it in a really interesting and authentic way.
Yeah.
So it's a tall order, but it's certainly in our wheelhouse of discussion and debate.
Well, mm-hmm. I appreciate that you mentioned that it was something you had contemplated even before Andrew had passed, and yeah, mm-hmm. I suppose it sort of suggests that if Andrew had not passed, perhaps he would have been invited into the fold as well. But maybe I'm speculating. But I guess we won't know. So anyway, it's lovely. It's lovely to celebrate this band. And if people want to learn more about this collection, this set, I should say, Gang of Four, 77 to 81, and about you guys generally, I'm wondering if we can point people to where to go on the internet. Hugo, do you know where the best destination is?
Matador Records.
Yeah, you can buy it.
If you're in the South, Wuxbury Records. It's on Amazon. And of course, I mean, it is a limited box set. There were only 3,000 made. We quite deliberately did that. It's been very successful. I wish we'd made 4,000. But anyway, next month, John has just finished with the industrial design, as it were, for the box that will be a CD version of this. There won't be a cassette, but everything will be in there one way or the other, including the book.
Okay, excellent. Well, I really am honored to get to speak with both of you. And actually, before I gush and say goodbye, is there anything you want to talk about beyond Gang of Four? Like, are you, Dave, are you doing something that you want people to know about? I just want to give you this opportunity before we go.
No, not really. Not at this time.
Okay.
Of where we're at in 2021, which was meant to be better than 2020, you know?
Yes.
And like, you know, Richard, our manager, is saying that 2022, we might be able to get out into Europe for the festivals.
Oh, okay.
You know, hopefully that the COVID thing's like gone away, things like that.
So okay.
But this year is going to be another year like 2020. You know, it's like just keep going.
Yes, yes.
And I you know, this box set has been selling extremely well, according to Matador.
Yeah,
because it's very expensive. how much is it? Like,
what a bargain!
Is it 210?
I think no, it's 100. I think the list price is $175.
Oh, that's nothing. That's worth it.
That's not.
I think it's. I think it's a very good deal.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And, you know, I'll sign people's copies for another $500. That's
good to know, Hugo.
Send check to Hugo.
Value added.
Very, very honorable of you, Hugo, to offer that.
I'm an honorable man. Yeah. I'm an honorable man.
Do you have anything, Hugo, that you want to talk about before we go?
Dave traditionally has been the one to really dive into and be aware of new music. But I obviously Run the Jewels we're all very fond of. I'm not just saying this, but there's an Indian hard rock metal act called Bloodywood who I've been actually supporting and listening to for a year and a half now.
Okay.
Bloodywood. Look out, investigate. They're fantastic.
Were you about to say that you weren't just citing an Indian band because I'm Indian? Is that what you were going to say?
I suddenly thought, oh my God, he's only going to say this because he thinks I'm only saying this because of that.
I'm just teasing. That's funny though. I like that you had that catch. Like, should I talk about this Indian band with this Indian guy?
Yeah,
that's
funny. Would it sound like I'm a candidate? Anyway,
Hugo, when you started, what was it? Run the Jewels.
Run the Jewels. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, they did Ether.
They sampled one of our songs from Entertainment on their new album, which was so flattering and so wonderful. It sounds great.
That album
There's other little bands that are fun. There's a little punk band from Southern California called the Chonks, who I sort of follow on, I don't know, is it sound? Anyway, I'm aware, they're cool too.
Yeah.
There's stuff out. I mean, it's exhausting trying to keep up.
It is.
It's new.
It is weirder to try to do sort of any kind of musical discovery without going to shows. Like, that's the thing I keep talking about is, like, I used to love seeing how I discovered most bands was opening bands. Like, you talk about Run the Jewels. I once saw Killer Mike and LP play a show together. And then the next time I saw them, they were Run the Jewels. And then the first time it was very small. And then the next time, like, bigger and bigger arenas, festivals, and they've been on the show as well, and I love them, so it's nice. I appreciate that they love you too, that they sampled a song. And anyway, this has been a true honor, and I thank you both for making any time for me at all. I hope you enjoyed this, and I look forward to more Gang of Four stuff in the future, and best of luck with everything.
Thank you, Vish. This was fun to do, and I'm glad we were able to, so thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Hugo. Thanks, Dave.
And me. Yeah.
Right.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Hugo and Dave from Gang of Four for appearing on this, the 609th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever you get your podcast. If you can't find an episode that you're looking for, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit my website, vishkana.com. You can also like Creative Control on Facebook, if that's what your heart is telling you to do. You can also follow the show on Twitter at Vish Creative, creative with a K. Or you can follow me on Twitter and on Instagram at Vish Khanna. Also visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain this podcast. $6 or more a month grants you access to exclusive content. Although I feel like the site now says $8, but I had set it for $6. Maybe it's some sort of currency exchange thing. I don't know if it's $6 or $8, but one of the two. I said I had it set up for $6. Again, I'm in Canada. Maybe I'm seeing some weird exchange rate. Let's just go with $6 in some currency or more grants you access to exclusive content. And again, if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt, I mention this on the show every week. If you want a t-shirt, just message me on Patreon and I'll get you one while supplies last. I still have some, so. Again, everything you need to know, patreon.com/creativecontrol. Thanks again to the fine Alberta record retailer, Blackbird Music, which you can learn more about and place special orders at blackbird.ca. Also, thanks to liveatmasseyhall.com, where you can watch beautifully captured concerts by great Canadian artists. And also to Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton for their in-kind support for this show. All of the aforementioned supporters, I've linked to them in the podcast episode description. So if you want to really learn more about them, click on those links and you will be whisked away to their online homes. Speaking of online homes, jimguthrie.org is a great place to go to
to learn more about Jim Guthrie, who lets me use music for this show and is a sweetheart of an old friend of mine. So there you go, jimguthrie.org to learn more about Jim. And finally, thank you very much for listening to this episode featuring Dave and Hugo from Gang of Four. What a thrill that was for me to get to speak to them. I hope you enjoyed that. And we'll check out this box set, Gang of Four, 77 to 81, in whatever format you can access it in. If you've got the vinyl or can access the vinyl, I would recommend that. But the CD box set is available for order now, actually. You can order it at the Matador site. Again, links in the podcast description. Anyway, big thrill to have members of Gang of Four on the show. I'm glad you listened to this. I hope you enjoyed it. And we'll tell your friends to do the same. Maybe consider subscribing to the show to keep up with it. The podcast, that is, Creative Control. Thank you for doing all of those things. I will talk to you very, very soon. Goodbye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.